Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It's Monday, February 26, 2024. We got a great show for you today. My name is Magnus Tewald, and joining me today is...
Peter Haskell. Peter and Raymond Haskell.
Just to be specific, eh?
Well, it sounds better. It's like Charles Foster Kane. Sounds better than Charles Kane.
We are starting a special three-part series today on Speak Up. Called The Seventh Artists on Radio. We'll be getting to that in just a few moments. But it's a three-part radio series featuring a number of First Nations artists in discussion with some First Nations arts experts. And it is a series produced by the Orr Galleries and the SFU Galleries, and brought to you here on CJSF. And we're very pleased to be doing that. We're going to get going with the first section of that in just a few moments. Part two will air tomorrow at 10 o'clock, and part three on Thursday, also at 10 o'clock, as part of this special series. Later in the program, though, Peter is going to be talking about something about the roots of Donald Trump.
In 1991, there was a documentary about Donald Trump that they tried to present on cable television, but was sort of blocked by him for legal reasons. But it was placed online in 2015. So it says his ongoing things he did during the 1980s. And I have a few points, but it's called Trump, What's the Deal?
Great.
And if you want to access it, it's quite easy. Put Trump, What's the Deal into Google. Donald Trump documentary 1991 is one good way of getting it.
And we'll be having that conversation at about 10:45 in about 40-some minutes. First, though, we are going to bring you The Seventh. This special three-part series with artists Lauren Brevner and James Harry in conversation with Rick Harry, Cease Weiss, and Aaron Nelson Moody is moderated by Orr Gallery Director Jen Jackson and is a discussion about a gallery presentation also curated by Jen Jackson. As I say, this is part one today. We are going to air part two tomorrow and part three on Thursday, all just a couple of minutes after 10 o'clock. So here is The Seventh Artists on Radio.
But also our commitment to support the capacity of art to unsettle these conditions. We would like to welcome each of you to this really special panel today. And I'm very grateful for the vision of Jen Jackson, the Orr Gallery Director, in creating this partnership for our program today. Now I'll welcome Jen Jackson to speak. Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us on this beautiful afternoon for the seventh panel conversation on Coast Salish Design Principles in Intersectional Collaboration with artists James McCullis, Willacton Rick Harry, Tetsnet Cease Weiss will be joining us shortly, and Aaron Nelson Moody, also known as Splash. Our wonderful colleague and friend, artist Lauren Bremner, and the star of the show, Baby Hannah, are unable to join us today as they are under the weather. I am Jen Jackson. My pronouns are she, her. I am the director at Orr Gallery and the curator of the seven. It is an honor to be here today and to welcome stories of the land from our esteemed panelists. The stories that will be shared this afternoon offer an active and ongoing acknowledgement that the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples and territories are timeless, that the rich and culturally diverse descendants of this territory are always in dialogue with the Hunkaminos and Squamish voices that echo upon the land. Today, artists will discuss Coast Salish design principles and intersectional collaboration as it relates to Lauren and James' exhibition, Seven, on view at Orr Gallery until February 10, 2024. Together, they will discuss the exhibition's principles of Indigenous representation and land-based gestures in contemporary art. The conversation that we will share today acknowledges calls for Indigenous sovereignty across and in solidarity with communities near and far. It offers an opening for discussion on the ways that we can stand with each other and direct our voices to powerful change. Lauren and James have been collaborators since 2014. Lauren's practice is deeply inspired by her Japanese and Trinidadian heritage, while James' practice combines traditional Squamish histories, forms, and designs. They create meditative compositions that invite cross-cultural dialogue and embrace multiple expressions of personal, political, social, and spiritual practices. Their work ranges from large-scale public art to intimate portraits, incorporates a wide range of materials, and engages in bridging community through generous relationality. As Lauren and James worked together on the Seventh, they spent time with elders, knowledge keepers, and storytellers in their communities. We are honored to have their family here with us today and to share a welcome song led by one of their most influential mentors and generous supporters, James's father, Squamish artist and master carver, Willacton. Willacton, welcome and thank you for being here.
Osea, it's already been acknowledged that Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, but the song we would like to share is coming from Katlacha. Katlacha, we call it the Chief Sign Baker. It's my mother's uncle, so it would be my granduncle. And he called this his welcome song. Hey,
thank you, Lachman, Aaron, and James. Lachman, your generosity and teachings reverberate deeply in my own understanding of Lauren and James's work. We raise our hands to you, to the light that you bring to each of us today, and to the spirit that you bring to the room and always keeping a smile on our faces. Thank you. We'll now invite James to give us a 20-minute presentation on Coast Salish design principles. Following the presentation, we'll have a brief 10-minute intermission, and then we'll invite our esteemed panelists to share a conversation together.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, for coming this afternoon. We've been working on this body of work for the last year. We've dedicated pretty well a whole year to creating this work, all kind of stemming from the idea of like where Coast Salish art comes from, trying to explore this form that has almost gone extinct. My dad appeared to be one of the generation to really bring it back to the public eye in a way that has really made a lasting impact. So a lot of my work is actually stemming from his practice, as well as Slash as well, because my dad has mentored a lot of other artists, Slash being one of them, and it's been such an honor and privilege to grow up being able to be surrounded by so many great artists and thinkers and really change makers around bringing our culture back, because there's been a huge desire for people now, especially within the last decade, to really change and shift how we look at it traditionally, but also how we can look at it moving forward in a more contemporary context. So my presentation here is actually aimed around sort of the philosophy and design language of Salish art, just to give you guys a little bit of context and background to where Lauren and I's collaborations are, and really just how much work it takes to kind of go into how to study the forms. And you know, I myself have taken the time to learn my dad pretty well my whole life to learn these forms. So I put in the work to understand the design language, to then shift it and change it into more contemporary context. So I'll just start off by going around on the territories and giving a little bit of background knowledge. So a lot of people coming to Canada or on the Pacific Northwest for the first time, a lot of the time they see a lot of prominent figures such as totem poles. In fact, I think I can safely say that most of the world knows this part of the world for totem poles. And that's really been a lot of the heart of what I'm trying to change as well, because this is, these are sort of describing First Nations people that aren't from this territory. And I think a lot of that issue too is that there's just so few of us to be pushing our artwork out into the world. And you know, it's really just starting to grasp in a more recent times where we're getting more of our work out here. That not shown in here is actually Susan Point's, I guess it was the two house posts and the beam that was recently done in light of this. But even in that, I don't think that's necessarily enough. So I want to give some more context in this, because you know, I know that Vancouver is pretty it's a cultural hub for BC. So I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing so many different types of First Nations artwork represented on our land. A lot of it's also partly due to institutions commissioning agencies, commissioning artworks by artists such as Bill Reid and Jim Park, that very prominent artists of their time, to display artworks in these locations. And particularly these pieces being of the Musqueam territory. And I know that there's a lot of back and forth between that. In fact, I know that my dad had recently worked with the O'Day Museum up in Whistler, that being a Jim Hart piece going up where he constructed and created the base so that the height artwork didn't touch Salish land, and sort of that being the starting conversation of, hey, guys, this really shouldn't be the artwork that's represented on our territory. Because historically speaking, you would look at these and they would be marking your territory in some regard. Your crests or your family crests would be represented on the totem pole, and you would marry into a family. You might create a new totem pole in regards to more people being introduced to your family, so you would add in those family crests. And these often would be found on waterfronts for people as you're passing by, so you know whose territory that you're paddling up to. Whereas here, we did it quite different. We actually had welcome figures with their hands out. You know, if you guys go to Ambleside Beach in West Van, we have a welcome figure out on the ocean front welcoming people in. So we didn't actually carve totem poles on our ocean fronts. They are, in fact, found on the inside of our big houses. So just a map of Coast Salish. So this is a map of Coast Salish design areas where Coast Salish people would practice Coast Salish design. So it would span as far north as parts of Vancouver Island. We're actually, our family on our grandmother's side in another bay called Kudal or Kukwakuwak, where it was a mix. And correct me if I'm wrong while I'm speaking. Namgis as well. So it's where it was more of a help me out here. A mix, because I don't want to say the wrong thing. Namgis is a mix between Kukwakuwak and Coast Salish. So there was a lot of intermarriages in between different nations, which added to the complexity of what that would mean when we're creating artwork here. Because on my dad's mom's side, my grandma, she's Kukwakuwak, so we actually did practice carving totem poles from that territory. But on my grandpa's side, his dad, he was Squamish, so we do a little bit of both, and in more recent times, and I've been following after my dad's practice here too, is that we are only creating Coast Salish design because we're saying we're here on Coast Salish land. So we're not trying to practice our northern style as much, just because Salish style and Salish art is, like I was saying before, it almost gone extinct. So here's some examples of some house posts. Here on the left, that was a welcome figure I was speaking to earlier. And you can see an example of my dad's work here at the Squamish Lulik Cultural Center, which is sort of a more contemporary take on a house post. And sort of taking examples of the past here. You can see at the top right, that the figures would have been represented on the inside of the big houses or the long houses, so they would have been architectural features to the houses themselves. And then here you see down here the comb design, and as well as the spindle whorl. And a lot of these examples are taken from things that are actually serve as functional purposes as well, as not just art, because we actually didn't have a word for art. So to go into understanding Coast Salish design, I want to give a brief sort of introduction to the design language, which only derives out of three different forms, the crescent, the circle, and the trigon. And at first, when I learned this from my dad, I found it quite difficult to find out how you create artwork using only three forms. But when you start to piece them together, you sort of get this directionality or this movement or flow through a piece, this being a really quite simplified version of a feather design. So it's more of like an abstract piece. But the energy from the artwork always starts from the center point in a direction, and everything sort of flows outwards from that. As sort of if you can imagine dropping a pebble in water, how there's that energy moving outwards in all directions. So that same sort of design principle would be used if you wanted to guide the eye through a piece. You might use those forms in sort of, if you wanted to form the arc, that's how you would use those forms. So I'd like to show this example side by side of a new Chonov here, Thunderbird on the left, and a Salish Thunderbird on the right. And both they're actually quite the opposite. So form line coming from Northern First Nations artwork is based on three forms that sort of are building blocks. So they're more built in the positive space rather than the negative space. So you take an ovoid form and you build upon that using various forms. It's basically, I did it in black and white to represent that you can imagine that the Thunderbird being the positive silhouette shape and the black being the areas where you pierce through or cut through. And we can see in this example here how they the forms are sort of, again, it's still bringing in that design philosophy of movement where you're still moving towards this directionality and using the forms to guide the eye in a specific way or a specific motion. And you can see examples here in of these old designs in these spindle whorls that the shapes and forms were used sort of in that same way where there was sort of a starting point of this energy and movement, and everything sort of moved outwards from that. So that brings me to conceptualizing Salish art and into a more modern context. So after taking these forms and design philosophies, I wanted to bring them into a practice that would bring them into a more bringing them from the negative into the positive as sculptural pieces. So it's more really, I look at these as studies of the forms. And they kind of, I think, it's sort of interesting if you think about these in terms of public art in the context of our city, is that we're taking the forms where, you know, our ancestors were observers of nature, we studied nature, and the artwork came out of the land. So in a way, these works, they come out of the land. It's like sort of that idea that it's having this conversation with it, that it's rooted and based in the Salish design that sort of has this conversation with the historical meaning of what it means to be here in this territory, and specific to the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh, we all sort of use the same design language to kind of understand how these forms, what they mean to us, because it's so interesting to think about how we're also so connected to these forms. And you know, for me at least, I know that journey has been trying to find why that's so important for me, and I wanted to really know how these forms came to be. So I just went back to the natural world and started studying the forms that came from the land. And then as you work through it, you can kind of understand the relationship, especially as you can scale these pieces up. You can see here the set scale, I'm thinking of this little person down here in the bottom, that it starts to have a different relationship to the viewer, that it kind of makes the person feel sort of places them in a state of wonder or awe, and then maybe then we can reflect back to you know, what it means to be living in this territory, what it means to conceptualize Salish art in a contemporary context. I like to use examples of architecture, and this one being Sanok going up Sideborough Ridge, where we can start to see Salish form utilized in the buildings themselves, and thinking about how, rather than just placing a piece of artwork on a plot of land, how we can think about integrating art design philosophy into the rest of the world, whether that be architecture, landscape architecture, or design. And some of these bits are kind of where these ideas are formulated and begin as a dream, and sometimes they come to life and sometimes they don't. This one being a concept that I did for the Burrard Bridge. The idea being that we take that circle form and sort of pierce through the architectural stature of the building, or the bridge, sorry, and then also thinking about the functionality of a space, this being a bus stop down the bottom left, and thinking how you can use the form to design architecture as a function, but still stay true to the Salish form language. And almost sort of imagine what, you know, with the use of different material and light and just sort of reimagine what our spaces could look like in our city. Now, a lot of this started for me when I was doing public art. It's actually how I met Jen Jackson, was through public art, and imagining how we could bring these forms. At the time, I was thinking this is the only way I can get more of our forms onto our land. But since then, we've been trying to discover or look through other ways. That was sort of the show, the art show was taking that to the next level. But I really wanted to just give those brief overviews of those works, because it's sort of imagining, with the use of technology, giving people the idea of like how if an indigenous person was to design a place or design in our modern context, like we had the authorship to collaborate and work with architects and designers, what would our city look like? And that's kind of where a lot of my passion lies. But it's really trying to also imagine just like how you could use material in different forms. With working with my dad earlier on in life, we used to have so much access to yellow and red cedar, but as you know, in current day, we just don't have access to it anymore. So we've also sort of been forced into having to think through different mediums, just because the scarcity of old growth trees, you know. We wouldn't actually harm anything unless it was an old growth, because the grain and wood wouldn't be tight enough to carve. So it's almost sort of having to think about that in a different way. I wanted to bring this example up. This was a bid that I did for St. Paul's Hospital. Where the St. Paul's Hospital is actually being built on top of a vortex portal, squash ice. And in this bid, I really wanted to bring that story to life, because that was a really sacred space for the Squamish people. We have stories that date back thousands of years of our people hunting in that area. And we actually have a specific story of a hunter who was chasing down a sea lion, who actually had shot and harpooned the sea lion, and it had gotten away out of his sights, but he had been traveling about 6 months later from where he harpooned it in this location. He found it in Burnaby Lake, and that's how our people found out that there were underground tunnels linking from False Creek all the way to Burnaby. So, you know, our people have like all these really old sacred stories, and there's a lot of these opportunities that come up through bids like St. Paul's Hospital, where there's a real opportunity to bring those and shed light on those sacred stories. But we're still facing the fact of colonization. In this case, the bid didn't end up winning. And instead going to Northern Art again, so that in my eyes it's erasing and paving over our history and our context. So, you know, and all I can really do is, you know, I understand that it is it's a difficult and competitive process. But I think at the same time, there's something really systemic that needs to be changed in order for these types of projects to really flourish. Each pillar, I had spoken to a couple different chiefs from our nation, actually, to get a background story to each cardinal direction for each pillar. So each side of this pillar has a story that relates to that cardinal direction. In this specific case, being the West, the bear in the West. And you know, actually, a lot of our families have different stories of which animal belongs to which direction. So I really had to be like diplomatic with which which animal was on which pillar. So, the bear to the West, and this idea that it's representing rebirth, and the, you know, in the West represents destruction and rejuvenation. So the tree being a tree of life connected to the bear, the strength of our community and the resilience, and this idea of being reconnected through our ancestors. In the bottom you can see there's bones and of different types of animals that would have fed our people, and they also at the same time nourish all of these plants, just as our bodies nourish the cedar trees, which grow so large after we pass. The connection between the bear being the salmon and leaving the salmon near the trunks of the trees gives it this all these nutrients so that they can grow as big as they grow. And there's just so much interconnection in all of that. And our people never really looked at that as separate. It was always this idea that we belonged and were interconnected to all of this deep interconnected web of life. So with each piece, I try and keep that philosophy in mind, where I really want to invite the viewer to be part of that conversation. So as you look through each work, you move through a work, and it invites you to move through it. In a sense, it invites you to move through its spirit, that everything has a spirit. And it all relates back to the land, because each form that is created, I study based on the land itself. So this one being titled Breach, which is actually sort of an abstract version of a salmon or an orca breaching out of the water. But it's also open in the middle so that you can actually walk through the entire piece. And that's something that I love about being able to create such a grand scale work, is that it invites you to viscerally be part of it and connect to it and move through pieces. So it, much like it does to move through the land, and this piece being on the Squamish Ocean is representative of the bow and stern of our oceanic canoes. And I've represented the true to life scale size of how big our canoes would have been, using those old growth trees, up to 80 feet. And I know Splash, you're saying sometimes even 90 feet. Or kind of, I'm not sure, but huge, right? And it really invites us to think back to that past. And this is also part of a story that is connected to my dad. I was raised hearing him talk about his story of the Great Flood, and how we have stories connecting to Inchcape or Chukai, Mount Garibaldi, as some of you may know, in Squamish, that there was a Great Flood where it forced our village to raise up our canoes to escape the water and create a raft near the top of Inchcape. So this stands on the ocean front where it's actually framing Inchcape between the two canoes in relation from the ocean to the land to the sky, and again bringing in those philosophies. And each piece, I really try to start from a block of wood, because I feel as I work through the work, it's like I'm connected to my ancestors. And I've learned that through my dad over time, is that it's this real meditative state. It's like you know, it's almost like it's written in our code or our DNA to work through these materials. And that's what helps, you know, me create these forms, is that I'm relying on my ancestors to help me in this process, to realize these. And they really have a different energy about them when that process is engaged, because it forces me to slow down and think about what I'm doing. This is a form that's actually taken up after, this is the New Westminster Secondary, or sorry, New Westminster Aquatic Center that they're just completing next year. And the building was built on top of a ravine, Glenbrook Ravine. And I took the shape of the ravine and used that as the main form of the sculpture. And of course, I took my own artistic direction and creativity. But I really wanted, again, it to be about that conversation between the land, the artwork, as well as the sky. And it was really interesting, too, because if you look at the building, the architecture is also sort of mimicking it in some way, too, which I later found out that the architect also did the building based off of the ravine. So it was a really interesting conversation there, and maybe another example of how artwork and architecture can have conversations. Here's the piece that had been fabricated. It stands at 16 feet tall. It's a stainless steel finish, mirror polish, with the idea of it being like water, or it's like this reflective surface. And water being over, like, it's water is Mother Nature's chisel. It's always carving the landscape. And I always found that to be so fascinating, about how you go around different parts of the world and look at how water is carved, all these beautifully intricate forms and shapes into stone and rock and sandstone. Just so many beautiful curves and forms. And to my finding through this work, I found that there was a really interesting, happy accident, really, actually, not purposeful, that there was a trigon shape, which comes out of Salish design, that was carved by the ravine. So really, a really beautiful moment there. And this is an example of the seed from our recent exhibition at the 7th. the idea being that it's this form that's been sort of evacuated from the inside, and that's what's really interesting to me now is, as I've been working with Lauren over the years too, like, she's also helped form ideas around what that could mean to me, and it's been really inspiring to me to hear her words and her creative ideas. And I think that's where the intersectional collaboration really comes to light, is that it's really all just a conversation that we all have with each other. And I don't think we ever would have arrived here if it wasn't for the multiple art conversations that we've had over the years. This idea of this piece being a seed, and we're calling these the seed series. And we're talking of them as if they're seeds of knowledge, that they're spreading. This Coast Salish design is sort of spilling out into the world through these different forms. And they're abstract as they wrap around, but they become more, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? They're familiar as you see their projections on the ceiling and the ground. But as you have to move around it, it's more abstract, so you don't really get the full image. And there's some really interesting things that happen between light and shadow. And when we're thinking about, like, through when we went to Japan to kind of get some inspiration, thinking about how in Japanese culture, how there's a huge play between light and shadow. And I think that's when we went to Japan, there was a lot of that that came out of inspiration came from traveling up there. So this is a piece, this is it brought into reality. And this is another example. of a work that was just recently installed in Port Moody. With the idea that you're being invited to walk through. In this case, the title of this work is "How Come," which means blue mussel or mussel. And it's sort of a memorial for that site because it's located in Port Moody, but there is no shell life that really exists in there because of all the oil tankers, and the waters there are just too filthy for sea life to exist. But one can imagine once upon a time before European settlers came that there must have been so much sea life that would have been available in the Brevard Inlet. And these here are the pillars that we recently created for the 7th. And this is an example of how we imagine them to be integrated into architecture. And here are the pieces themselves one of them is on show right now at the Orr Gallery, so if you haven't been there, go check it out. But the piece that's at the Orr Gallery is here on the right, and you can see again how it projects the shadows down onto the ground, sort of like the seeds of knowledge spreading those forms back onto the land. And you have to see part of this is for landscape architects, so I included some inspiration for landscape architects to imagine how our Salish forms could be used as an inspiration. And I think that concludes my presentation. It's just one last note on this piece. This is a lighting design that we're also working on creating these new lights for institutions to bring more such art into the landscape. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Every time I hear you speak, it expands and transforms the way I understand this place and this territory. And I've seen you give this talk many times, and you always add something new and bring something new to the table for us to consider.
And that's the conclusion of part one of our three-part presentation of the 7th Artists on the Radio. this presentation, which will continue tomorrow at just a couple of minutes after 10 o'clock, features artists Laura Brevner and James Harry in conversation with Rick Harry, Cease Weiss, and Aaron Nelson Moody. Moderated by Orr Gallery Director Jen Jackson. That's who we heard at the end there. We'll be bringing you part two tomorrow at about 10:03. And part three on Thursday at the same time. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Peter Haskell and the dark history of...
I'm going to talk about the 1991 film documentary on him, which was done in context of him not being president or trying to be president, but in NEMA, what he was doing during the 1980s.
And showed up some of his sort of unsavory tactics.
Well, okay, we'll go over it after yep. Bird Note.
All right.
This is Bird Note. When birds swallow berries, they also ingest the seeds within the pulp. After just half an hour or so, they dispose of the seed by passing it through their digestive system, or regurgitating it. Either way, the hard seeds wind up on the ground. There's an evolutionary reason for this. Plants that evolved fruits with edible flesh could attract birds to eat them. Then the birds transport the hard seeds within the soft fruits to new spots for them to take root. But birds do more than just carry the seeds. Their digestive system, including their muscular gizzard, grinds away the hard outer coating on seeds, making them more likely to germinate once the birds deposit them. What's more, seeds in a bird's droppings are prepackaged in nutrient-rich fertilizer when they hit the soil. Birds disperse seeds for more than 300 trees, bushes, and vines in North America. The benefits are mutual. A fruit-eating bird sows more fruit-bearing plants, leading to more fruit for birds to reap in the future. It's a relationship developed over millennia of coevolution. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
So, Peter, tell us about this film.
It's called Trump, What's the Deal? And they tried to get it on cable TV in the New York State area.
Yep.
And they failed. I think they had a theatrical showing. Leonard Stern, which was a business rival, financed part of the film, but it was created not solely by him. He was just did some of the financing of it.
So, what was it about the film that caught your interest?
Well, one thing. It's been online since 2015, and what I came across in 2016, it came across me that it wasn't sort of brought up. Mm-hmm. There are two things I think which are quite damning. One is a bit lighter, and I'm going to go to the second one after that. One was that supposedly in 1986, because of Donald Trump, The public ice rink in Central Park had to be reopened, and the city had spent a lot of money doing it, and it failed to bring it up. And then he actually was paid to have it done, and he got somebody else, a Vincent Desmeno, who kind of cajoled him. He wound up not getting paid at all. And it was like, oh, I just did it for the city of New York, when he actually got paid and someone else did free work on it. Now, that's a bit of a lighter one, still pretty bad. I don't like someone taking credit and being paid for... but this was... It was one of his buildings, was Trump Tower. And the contractor for the demolition of the first building... Mm-hmm. The contractor he got was just a window washer. That's what he had done previously. And he hired 200 illegal Polish workers. And at that time, Poland was still part of the communist bloc countries. And interestingly enough, you would have thought that they would have said, okay, come to the United States, it's fine. But no, it was they were illegal, of all things. They were paid one-third of the union rate, and they wound, and the actual contractor did not pay them, and there was a court case over this, and actually one of Trump's own employees, the former labor negotiator with the Trump Organization, he says a few things. What happened was the workers had no masks, no gloves for stripping bare wires with their bare hands, and asbestos was part of the building too. And in the court case, that sort of happened. This is sort of a really interesting thing. Donald Trump's sister at the time was assistant to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I think she became a judge later, which I was a bit surprised because I remember seeing the film. I forgot about that fact. So not very good. That's the one thing that stood out for me. And actually, the one thing I've heard about him is that in contracting, you're basically paid three times. Like, you're paid at the beginning, the middle of the job, and at the end. And Trump supposedly, repeatedly, This is not in the documentary, but he's not paid the last third in the past. Like, he just lets the last third just go. And it gets away with it.
It's yeah, there are lots of stories about that, of him not paying people he's got contracts with, people who do work for him.
So as I say, it's done in a thing where he basically gets away with the last third because of the jurisprudence of it. It becomes next to impossible to get.
Yeah, I mean, someone has to sue him for the money, and then even if they win a judgment, they have to be able to collect the money from him, which he already owed them, and he didn't pay in the first place. So why is he going to pay the second time around?
And the other thing, we got to talk a bit about Roger Stone, too, some of the information. But to finish off on the film, I was a bit surprised that during the 2016 campaign, this was not brought up. It just sort of lied there. I mean, it was something very obscure and remains obscure to this day. In fact, the Hillary Clinton campaign didn't bring it up or whatever. So I don't, maybe because they're all corrupt in these ways and they don't want to, I don't know. Why it wouldn't be brought up more.
It's hard to say whether it would have made a difference because there have been so many other scandals with Donald Trump that would seem to end the career of any normal politician, but he's clearly not a normal politician. He seems to get away with just about anything in terms of having a history of bad practice. Because another story that came up, and it might have been around the time of the 2016 election, was his Trump University, where he started a private university and collected lots of tuition fees and et cetera from students who had to take out loans for all this stuff. And then in the end didn't provide a decent educational experience worthy of either the name of a university or the money he was paid. And then he got sued for that and lost the case, but people still didn't seem to care.
I didn't enroll, but I went to the, this was quite a while ago, there was some place in Surrey, you know, the hotel thing. This was way before the election run, I think 2010 or maybe a bit earlier, but it was, I think it was what you were speaking of, and I went to see the presentation to supposedly enroll in this thing, which seemed quite fraudulent, actually.
So you dodged a bullet there.
No, well, I was just interested. There was no way I was going to get involved with something like that.
Yeah.
No, but I saw the practices. He was encouraging people even to make a loan and so on. I think that was created because he had to pay property tax on all his properties or something.
Oh, probably.
He was strapped for cash. One of the creators kind of the Trump presidency was Roger Stone, is Roger Stone still.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just on Wikipedia on Roger Stone, but this is sort of interesting about him. Mm-hmm. He was part of a lobbying firm. Actually, they call the term mega lobbying firm. He was last named Black, Manafort, and Stone. And it operated 1980 and 1991. Now, two of their clients was Federal Marcos of the Philippines. And another one was Azuer, the president of Azuer. I checked it up a bit because I thought, well, you know, they got their independence from Belgium. It might have not have been a bad thing, but it was, basically. How he first met Trump in 1979 as part of the Reagan campaign. And it was Roy Cohen who introduced him. He got to meet Trump. And Roger Stone met Roy Cohen, who was the lawyer for Joseph McCarthy, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he seemed to be a big deal in a lot of somewhat nefarious, or not nefarious, but unsavory dealings over an extended period of time.
Yeah, so anyway, actually there was a attempt in the year 2000 to have a third part, have Trump part of a third party candidate that Ross Perot and Jesse Ventura were part of,
right,
which didn't go anywhere. But so actually, over the years, I mean, in many ways, that the concept of Trump running as president is sort of a Roger Stone concept in many ways, and it was 2019. He was, but the helicopters came for him. He was placed in jail. Yeah,
are you talking Roger Stone?
Yeah, Roger Stone. Yes, and then, but he got pardoned after he lost the election in December 2020. He got pardoned by Trump, but I had heard that he couldn't legally pardon him for some complicated reason, but I looked it up today in the Wikipedia on this, and supposedly he was pardoned, but I think it was a more elaborate legality than that, because he had sort of, anyway, things got complicated or whatever.
So where can people find this film? Is it on YouTube?
Yeah. I would go to Google directly. It's called Trump. What's the Madeal? I would put Donald Trump 1991 documentary onto Google, and you'll get it very quickly.
Yeah. And of course, the reference there is because he had I think one of his big rises to fame was when he published a book called The Art of the Deal, which sort of paint a self-written sort of thing, which painted it as some sort of master of deal making.
I guess that's why. I mean, I just as a side note got the title of it.
Yeah.
And actually, in the middle of 1990, he was in debt $294 million. So Donald Trump. So
yep.
But they say if he put all his money that he got from his family, he was born rich, into status and poor's, he would have more money than
he
has.
If he just invested it instead of trying to be a businessman.
Well, just on like an automatic pilot. He would, if he just put it in there, he would have gotten more than he has now.
Yep. Well, you know, Trump's a personal hype machine, and he rode it all the way to the presidency, and who knows if we're not, if he could happen again. All right, so Donald Trump, what's the deal? You can, easiest to find it just by Googling that or Donald Trump.
Well, just as a...
you can see that his go ahead.
I was going to say, there was a 2016 interview with Charlie Rose and Roger Stone. And Roger Stone said he's not the Wall Street establishment or country club Republicans. Republicans. He wasn't country club Republicans or Wall Street establishment. And that's what Roger Stone thought was wonderful about Donald Trump.
And that remains the truth today with all the establishment Republican sidelined within the Republican Party, because it's basically his party these days.
Yeah, well, he sort of, I mean, it was supposed to be Jeb Bush was supposed to be the candidate 2016.
And he crashed out early. All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you, Peter. Peter will be back next Monday with another chat for us. Tomorrow we have part two of the 7th Artists on Radio. That'll be coming up at just after 10 o'clock. With part three airing on Tuesday. Ayu Sakamoto will also be in tomorrow with her bringing her arts review. And that'll be on the radio just after we complete the segment on the 7th, the Artists on Radio segment. So we'll be back tomorrow. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming up in a few minutes or moments is Democracy Now! And up at 12 noon is... Wandering Rhythms with Nick Legacy. He's away in Peru now, and he's going to be coming back soon with some great stuff.
Hey, SFU. Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Returned Express for free. You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. Return It will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.